The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
This morning on The Breakfast Grill, we are pleased to have the former Prime Minister of New Zealand and Administrator of the UN Development Programme, Helen Clark. Good morning, Ms. Clark, and welcome to the programme. Now, the UNDP champions various development goals, touching on the environment, to education, and to gender equality. Give us a sense as to where we are in that framework.
The Sustainable Development Goals were launched with a big fanfare and a Global Leaders Summit at the UN September 2015. But here we are, close to 2.5 years after that, and countries need to get busy because the period of the goals runs through to 2030. That time can go very, very fast if you're not focused. So what I found in my time at UNDP was that many of the developing countries we worked in, more than 100, came forward asking for support of various kinds from the UN agencies, which were led by UNDP and country. And one of the main things they were seeking was help with putting the Sustainable Development Goals and ambition into their national development plans, which is very positive. They also were seeking support on how to measure progress, how to set their national indicators, and then for engaging the society, the broader society, because you have to have the private sector on board. You have to have civil society on board. You need all levels of government on board, from the municipality and the county up to the national government. So it was very satisfying work to be in because developing countries were taking these so seriously, and so have a number of developed countries, not all. I think they could learn a little from the seriousness of developing countries on this.
If you can boil it down to the Malaysian context, then how far are we, and not just in terms of integrating those goals that you outlined into our national programs, but also how much progress have we actually made?
Malaysia's made incredible progress. I first came here in 1995. Already, Malaysia had achieved an incredible amount, but here it is. It's on the cusp of becoming a high-income country, right? As the Prime Minister's speech at this conference showed, the level of poverty is down to the barely measurable, less than half of a percent. So we can say on the basic socioeconomic indicators, Malaysia's doing well. It's doing well on income, it's doing well on health, it's doing well on education. Now I think what it needs to look at is, are inequalities widening or narrowing? That may need attention. What about the gender issues? The participation of women in the workforce is still not where it could be. What policies need to go around that? And then on environmental sustainability, has Malaysia got the level of energy efficiency that it would like to have, the water efficiency? Is it future-proofing itself for climate change? This is a peninsula. It's surrounded by water. That has implications with rising sea levels, increasing numbers of severe weather events. So I would think that for Malaysia, it will be that resilience to climate change, adaptation, trying to get the carbon footprint down, which will be very important, looking at its biodiversity, which is also covered in the goals. But it's doable. This country has the means, it has the capacity, intellectual and monetary and physical, to do these things.
Earlier you mentioned needing the support at the grassroots level, right? Yet when you look at sentiment on the ground, inequality still very much a bread and butter issue, especially as we now find ourselves in the lead up to the next general elections. So how do you justify the gap between these rising economic indicators that you alluded to earlier versus the sentiment that still points to this widening, this yawning inequality?
Well, it's a global issue. Many countries have experienced a growing gap. My own experienced a growing gap with the significant restructuring of the 1980s on. And in my time as Prime Minister, we endeavoured to address that, both with high levels of employment, lifting minimum wages, which then had a lifting effect throughout the wage structure, and then also ensuring that we had a tax system that was friendly to families, that had cash transfers, because the income that will support a single person is not the income that will support a family in many respects. So there are many ways of tackling inequality. And in the end, if a country is doing well, as New Zealand has, as Malaysia has, everyone wants to be part of that story and not be left behind. And one of the basic principles of this new global agenda is leave nobody behind. If you leave people behind, you start to lose your social cohesion, your sense of social solidarity. It means trouble. No one wants trouble. So let's address the issues of inequality so that permanent divisions don't grow.
But in addressing those inequalities, political leaders here in Malaysia will have to fend off political pressures. Some may not place as high an emphasis on sustainability, you know, versus good old top-line economic growth, right? So how do political leaders, especially here in Malaysia, then try to fend off those pressures while achieving that sustainable agenda?
Well, sustainability needs leadership, and it's not easy. I remember in my time as Prime Minister, where we had to take climate change seriously, we had, of course, agricultural base to the economy, which needs an equable and predictable climate, and we have a less and less predictable climate. Now, you could argue that what Malaysia does or what New Zealand does is not that important in the overall scheme of things, but unless we all see we're in this together and act on it, we have a global problem. So I found that when you ask New Zealanders, and maybe when you ask Malaysians, should the government be doing something about climate change? Most people say, yes, yes, they should. And then you say, do you want to pay more for your petrol? And they say, no. But so you have to, you know, be working on raising the awareness of what has to be done to get the carbon footprint down and to design our cities and our public transport systems and our energy systems so that we're less reliant on the fossil fuel and more on renewable, sustainable ways of powering and transporting and designing our societies.
But are there opportunity costs to this sustainable agenda then in pursuing a more sustainable business model and, you know, one that's more friendly to the environment? Could it come at a cost of, say, economic growth?
I think you're going to face the cost long-term of not doing it, particularly as consumer awareness grows of how products and services are developed. For example, I would say in the West these days, people don't want to buy a bar of soap if they know the palm oil and that came from land which was just deforested and maybe took away the habitat of the orangutan, right? So you do have ethical consumers. And this will spread. Asia has a fast-growing middle class which cares about these issues too. So the future of business does lie in it being able to demonstrate that it takes sustainability seriously. Now, if you take a commodity like palm oil, there's actually quite a good news story about the major companies and about 90% of the buying power committing to deforestation-free supply chains. That really matters. Now, it needs government leadership too. It needs work with the smallholders to get, you know, better production off the land that is already cleared. But it is doable. And I'm now seeing reports of major companies going to deforestation-free supply chains for cocoa, for example. It needs to happen for coffee, for cattle, for soybean, whatever. But we can get a movement rolling where private enterprise actually seizes it and leads it because it sees it as the way of the future.
So does this warrant a relook at how capitalism is defined? For example, during your tenure as the Prime Minister of New Zealand, you push back against neoliberalism. What does capitalism today mean to you? Or what should it mean to us?
Well, I found in quarters of the New Zealand business community, there was a very, very narrow attitude which said that all that mattered was return to shareholders, right? Whereas actually business doesn't exist as an island. Business is part of society. And the great businesses are demonstrating that you can be profitable but also be sustainable and be inclusive, be a good citizen, a model of corporate citizenship. So that's what I always wanted to encourage. When I went to UNDP, similarly, I was able to work with companies that wanted to be part of that movement, wanted to be leaders. And I found that really quite inspirational how far, you know, some were prepared to go. So we always have to work from what's best practice, what's one company done that's worked, can we spread these ideas to others. We had inclusive business model organization serviced by UNDP, which worked with companies on how to make your business inclusive and sustainable.
I'm speaking to Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of New Zealand and administrator of the UN Development Program. We'll be back with more right here on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying with us here on The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9. I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me is the former Prime Minister of New Zealand and Administrator of the UN Development Programme, Helen Clark. Now, with the UN's approach, some will criticize it as being slow, expensive. At the same time, it hints at a top-down approach. So how do you accommodate, say, local sensitivities when trying to achieve this global agenda?
Well, one of the things I loved about UNDP was long before I ever went there, it had an ethos of no one size fits all. That we were there as, if you like, people who could catalyze action, working with the governments, the society, the businesses, to support them to design their own solutions, but never take one off the shelf and say, Malaysia, that's how you should do it. That's not going to work. Every society has their context, their cultures, their customs, and they have the capacity to design what is best for them while aiming to achieve global goals. As many roads to Rome, as the old saying goes. So the aim of people in development should be not to prescribe, but to say, okay, let's work together to figure out how this could be done, taking into account the local context.
Here in Malaysia, for example, the new version of the TPP, there are several carve-outs to accommodate Malaysian sensitivities.
Oh, and right? The New Zealand sensitivities.
Right, there we go. Does that risk diluting these ideals that you outlined there?
No, I don't think so. I think actually the new New Zealand government identified a couple of points where it just had to have change. Having got that change, we now have overwhelmingly support in our parliament for that agreement. So when I was Prime Minister, we did a lot of free trade deals. We were the first Western country to do a deal with China. But in order to satisfy our constituencies, we had to have as part of that side agreements on environment and labour standards, or our people wouldn't have tolerated it. So, you know, these things were important to us, and we needed to be able to negotiate in good faith with others to get them.
And also, given recent global developments, I'm talking about Brexit, I'm talking about the rise of protectionism, not just in the US, but other economies as well. You know, does that alter the conversation here? You know, how much does it put to risk the UN's global sustainability agenda?
Yes, where societies turn in and want to maximise their own interest without thinking of relations with others, it is detrimental. It does have implications for support for the international system. And yet, you know, I come from a small country. Malaysia is bigger than my country, but relatively speaking, it's a small country. We need the international rules-based order because on our own, we don't have weight or might to push anybody around. We need international law. We need disputes tribunals. We need these things. So I think at this time, it's very important for all of us, smaller and medium-sized countries, to hang together and say the international institutions matter to us.
Now, with China stepping up as well to the plate, you know, in light of the US shying away from these global agendas, what do you make of it? Because they don't exactly have the most stellar track record when it comes to human rights, equality, etc., right? How do you find the room or the rationale to welcome their presence and their influence while trying to make sense of their track records?
Well, it's good that China is in the international rules-based order. New Zealand was actually the first country that recognised China's market economy status, and I think the first to negotiate the bilateral accession agreement for China to enter the WTO, because we took the view that it's better to have China in and included in part of that order than to be sitting outside. Now, I must say, I have been impressed at how China has stepped up on the Paris Agreement on climate change, how it stepped up on the SDGs. There will be many views about One Belt, One Road. But hey, if China is going to put investment into the prosperity of its neighbours, that's not a bad thing. At UNDP, we signed a partnership to work with China on Belt and Road to make it an inclusive and sustainable initiative. So to make it a vehicle for the SDGs and not for old-style development, which didn't take regard of those things. So look, you know, the world's what it is. We work with what it is. China is a huge power, and it can do a power of good. Let's work with it.
Ms. Clark, let's talk about your home country. Now your former staffer, Jacinda Ardern, now Prime Minister of New Zealand, taking over after 9 years of the National Party being in power. How do you place the New Zealand context today? Does it differ from the one that you helmed until 2008?
Well, I was very proud of what I was able to achieve as Prime Minister with my government. In New Zealand, power alternates between governments of the centre-left, led by the Labour Party, which was my party, and governments of the centre-right. What you find is that Labour will build up investment in a range of areas, infrastructure, public transport, etc., and it will build up social provision. But then a Conservative government will come along and it will prioritise cutting taxes over maintaining those investments. So Jacinda Ardern, her challenges are to deal with a level of child and family poverty, which is not acceptable in New Zealand. There is a housing crisis in Auckland, our biggest city. The city has grown faster than the number of housing units required to house people properly, particularly low-income people. She inherits a country that hasn't really done anything much on climate change for the last 9 years and where there's a water quality crisis. So just those three things, poverty, homelessness, and tackling climate change and water quality, that would keep you busy for the next 3 years. And that will be what she's very focused on.
But given that, you know, she comes after 9 years of the national government, do you feel that your legacy has been somewhat diluted?
Well, put it this way, the major institutional changes and reforms and policies we put in place actually weren't changed, but they withered a little with lack of attention. So now the watering can will be out on the garden again and it will get a fresh lease of life, which I really look forward to.
Ms. Clark, you're also here in KL to attend the World Capital Markets Symposium, and gender equality is one of the key themes out of this symposium. Given the overall patriarchal nature of societies in Asia, right, how does that message cut through those biases?
I think if you can't make an impact with arguments around it being the right thing to do to pursue gender equality, you fall back on the economic arguments, which is that societies which don't have gender equality are selling themselves short. If you're not harnessing the full potential, for example, of the labour force of women, well, your GDP is going to be less than it could be. I think for Malaysia to achieve this high income status, which is very prominent in the country's national strategy, it will need more women at work. But that won't just happen. Women need the supports to do that. They need the childcare. It's got to be affordable. They need the time out when they've got small children, the paid parental leave. They need men to take some more of the responsibility for that. The length of the annual holiday will be important. So the society has to be supportive of these choices, and that's about social policy and about investment.
Is the economic argument the sole argument? What about the morality of it? Now, how does that get communicated to the masses?
Hillary Clinton once put it in a few words. She said, gender equality is not only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. So if it's both right and smart, it's got a lot going for it.
Let's end on this note then, Ms. Clark. So what is your ambition for not just Malaysia, but the region here in the near term, in the context of the UN sustainability agenda?
Well, firstly, the region maintaining its peace and stability is critical. Without that, you don't get development. Look at how the countries of what we used to call Indochina were crippled by war all those years. So while Malaysia, Singapore were able to, you know, fire ahead, countries were buried in conflict, and it's taken a long time to catch up, and they haven't caught up with where your country is today. Secondly, absolutely have to build resilience to climate change. Do your bit on getting your greenhouse gas footprint down. But you're in an area where the seas are warming fast, the levels of the sea are rising, and you have to build resilience to that and to extreme weather events. I think everybody's watching with horror the plight of Cape Town, you know, the first major city in modern times to run out of water. In the past, when communities have run out of water and resources, they've died. Well, Cape Town can't die, but it has to have solutions. So this is like the canary in the mine. It's saying, big cities, wake up. you have major resilience challenges, and you better start investing in infrastructure that can cope with that.
Well, Ms. Clark, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. That was Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of New Zealand and Administrator of the UN Development Programme. I'm Tan Chung Han, and this is BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.